Welcome to the Race Ride Seek podcast. I'm Jesse Carlson, your host for today. And today we have a very exciting podcast. We're talking all about expeditions. It's a very new thing we're doing here at Curve. We've only been doing them for 6 months now. We've had two trips so far, one in South Africa, one in Argentina that only finished just a week ago. And it's the latest in the line of events. It complements the other things that we do, from our weekly rides, which we do on a Thursday morning here at Curve in Melbourne, gravel and trails, women's ride that Sarah runs. We've got our monthly rides, we've got flashpacking trips, we've had endurance races, bikepacking races, like Race to the Rock and the Rhino Run. And now to complement all of those, we've got expeditions to bucket list locations around the world. They're experiences that we've carefully curated. We just want to share the type of riding that we love and encourage and support others to get out there and do something that they might not otherwise do. And today we're talking to Gus Burrell. Gus is our expedition specialist here at Curve. He is the man who has crafted these experiences and who leads them. We're very lucky to have Gus on board. Gus has had some fantastic experiences touring the world, some of the very remote parts of the world on bike, and so he's very well equipped to sort out any issues that may arise. I don't think anything phases Gus. I've known Gus for a while. I've seen him in some very phasable moments, and I don't think his blood pressure is able to rise. He's just a very level-headed, calm fella, which you often get from people who grew up on farms. Gus grew up near Narrabri. And he's toured many parts of the world by bike. And so we're very lucky to have him on the team. And so today we're talking about the expeditions that we've run so far and what to expect with them, and some of the stories along the way, from being interrupted in your post-ride drinks and food by a giraffe somewhere in South Africa, through to sandwiches and picnics on the salt flats and the high plains in northern Argentina. So anyway, I'll leave it at that. I caught up with Gus in his hotel room in Salta not too long ago. So I hope you enjoy the podcast. Okay, I am joined now by Gus Burrell, our expedition specialist. Where in the world are you, Gus? Where on earth are you?
G'day, Jerry, JC. Mate, I'm in Salta, Argentina, having just finished our El Gaucho expedition, just over a week ago. So I'm just here letting the dust settle and, reliving all the great memories.
Probably gotten a little bit of rest finally, although that's probably combated by trying to speak Spanish all day and having a fried brain by the evenings.
Yeah, exactly. It's been good to just, catch up on a bit of sleep and see all of the gauchos off home safe and sound. My Spanish is definitely getting a good workout here, mate.
That's good. All right, so today we are talking about this new thing we're doing here at Curve, Expedition. So we've got all options covered these days at Curve. I mean, we do a weekly women's ride here at HQ in Melbourne, gravel and trails every Thursday morning. It's a great little community built up there. We do our monthly rides around the traps in Victoria. We also do flashpacking trips as well, where we try to encourage people to sort of get off the couch and do something a little bit more adventurous. Then we've had races as well. We do these ultra endurance races, the Race to the Rock, the Rhino Run. We're involved in the Indy Pack as well. And now, to fill the gap, we've brought in what we're calling expeditions. And I guess this is all in an effort to just get you off the couch, share the type of riding that we love to do ourselves, and I guess encourage you to do something that you might not have otherwise done. And so Gus is heading up the expedition arm. And we've had two expeditions so far, Gus, is that right?
Yeah, that's right, too. One in South Africa and just now here in the north of Argentina.
So I guess we've got a program of three expeditions laid out for this year. We've got a third one in Romania. But maybe we start by just saying, okay, well, why on earth South Africa? Why on earth Argentina? Why do we want to encourage people to go to these places?
Well, yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think, like you mentioned just earlier, you know, what the expeditions are all about is us wanting to share the type of riding that we really love and enjoy, getting people off the couch and getting people out to see some destinations that they probably otherwise wouldn't maybe go and see, perhaps. Obviously, a lot of everyone listening probably knows or has heard of Ryan Riley, the great rhino, and he hails from South Africa.
That's what it's called, yeah. Man of many so, names, yeah.
Oh, yeah, there's endless. Yeah, so I think the brainchild for leading an expedition there really probably originated with Ryan, and obviously you mentioned the Rhino Run as well. That was something that was very close to Ryan's heart, so it was only natural to extend what we were doing last year with the Rhino Run, the race, by offering an expedition on the same course or part of the same course and allowing people to come and experience, you know, the first 750 or so kilometres of the Rhino Run. So it was sort of a tour or an expedition within a race, which was a bit different and a bit exciting. But a very, very interesting place to ride. So I guess that's how South Africa was born. And in terms of Argentina, the idea for riding through here came, I think, through a couple of different places. But obviously yourself and Sarah have done a pretty cool trip and a bit of great riding in this same region. I think that was that 2017 or something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, it might have been 2018. Yeah, it was a while ago
2018.
Yeah, 5 years ago, I think now. Jeez, time flies.
Yeah.
Yeah, and
I remember everybody sort of seeing some of the photos and hearing the stories of you guys riding through there, and a lot of people sort of thinking, wow, that looks amazing, and a lot of people pretty inspired to go and ride there. And then I myself, yeah, was sort of one of those people, I guess, and I wanted to ride down to Patagonia all the way through Argentina, and I chose that part of Argentina to start my trip, and I rode a lot of the similar roads that you guys rode, and for me it was quite a special personal experience of you know, riding through this beautiful country and experiencing the really, really rich cultural activity that goes on in the north that it's famous for. And yeah, I think it was sort of combination of those two trips and just conversations between us all, you know, going, this looks like a pretty amazing place to ride. It'd be pretty cool if we could actually bring people along and have them experience it as well. So I think that's probably the origin of those two destinations.
I think they're just also, the routes that we've come up with as well, they're just phenomenal routes as well. So that you get to experience, like the South African one, for example, sure, it's a kind of a unique one, in a way, because we've got the race running kind of at the same time, and yeah, it was pretty cool to see the races come past the expeditioners on close to the end of their trip last year. That was pretty cool. But the entree route that the expedition takes place on, it's a phenomenal course. Just we'll talk more about the experience a bit later, but just in terms of, you get a selection of those iconic South African gravel climbs, mix of real lovely coastal stuff. You've got the wineries or wine farms up further north towards Stellenbosch. Lovely coastal riding, you're crisscrossing that coastal range, some arid stuff too. It's just spectacular riding. And then, like you're saying, Gus, the Salta experience. I mean, Sarah and I went there on a Rafa photo shoot like 5 years ago. We're really lucky to have a quick trip there. And we're just blown away. You just draw that sort of 50 kilometer, just even a 50 kilometer radius around Salta, the city, and you've just got such a wide variety of riding, from, you know, getting up to the Salt Flats, you know, and towards the northwest, and then you've got the Andes, like huge mountain climbs. You've got those high altitude vineyards further south, and then you've got jungle if you wanted to head up to the sort of northeast of Salta as well. So it's just such a wild place. The landscapes are phenomenal, and so yeah, it's just a these are the sort of places as well where you just wouldn't go, oh yeah, I'll just book it, just go for a ride in northern Argentina. Unless you spend months of planning, you're not gonna necessarily find these spots, and you have a different sort of trip, obviously, but you probably need a bit more time and planning to sort it all out. But yeah, they're phenomenal places to ride, and yeah, it's been great seeing the photos of the trips come through. But I guess part of it as well, Gus, you were talking about a trip that you went on too. So you are no stranger to traveling the world by bike. Can you tell us a little bit about your adventures?
Yeah, well, I ended up spending a year or thereabouts living on my bike, living on my Kevin of Steel. This was in 2019, actually. And, it all kind of stemmed from an idea of wanting to see two places, Mongolia and Patagonia. And it wasn't, the idea originally came from the culture that resides in those two places. So it's a culture that's very dominated by horses, and the fact that the people that live in those places really rely on a horse to survive. The horse has very much been their means of transport and sustenance and, keeping them alive. And I guess, growing up on a farm, I was sort of always grew up with animals around and horses, and it was something that really drew me towards for a long time. And I guess in 2019, the time came where I could sort of go and explore. So yeah, I headed up to Japan and kind of crisscrossed my way across Japan, and then headed up to Mongolia, and I spent a couple of months between Mongolia and Kyrgyzstan, and just heading out into the far reaches, and spending sort of weeks at a time just away from any form of civilization, and sleeping under the stars, sleeping on the steppes, sleeping on high mountains, sleeping with local people, being invited into their yurts or their gurs, as they're called over there. And it was pretty amazing feeling and experience to actually not just be there, but to ride my bike through there and kind of do it, more or less on my own steam. The trip went on, and I sort of went made my way across to Europe, and eventually found my way down to South America, and that was sort of the big thing for me. It was going to be a big trip from the north of Argentina down to Patagonia. And I had my tent and my stove and, all of my sort of gear to survive any weather condition, because, here in the Andes it can be, it can be 40 degrees 1 minute and then snowing and blowing a gale the next. And so, it was a very, very exciting year, and I had a lot of adventures, had a lot of interesting places to sleep and a lot of interesting meals. Most importantly, I think I got to experience some amazing things by meeting people from locals from these places, and sharing meals with them or sharing beers with them or shots of vodka or whatever the local custom would be. I guess through all of that riding, I was able to witness a lot of pretty amazing places, and Argentina was definitely one that stuck with me. From everything from as I mentioned, the culture, the language, the food, the people, the way that they live their lives, and also the harshness of the life here. It's not an easy place to live. So, yeah, that probably gives a bit of background, I guess, a bit, to it.
Yeah, I think it's. I really wanted to cover a bit of that because it's important to know a little bit about who you are, Gus, as well. Like when we're crafting these trips, because it doesn't matter what sort of ride it is, whether it's a Tuesday morning ride in suburban Melbourne, or whether it's a flashpacking trip, or whether it's an expedition. The person who's kind of like leading that ride or leading that expedition really crafts the experience. And so I guess hearing you talk, Gus, it sort of makes me think, oh, well, this guy, he's had some incredible experiences out there. Probably knows how to get himself out of a spot of bother. Not too much phases him. You seem like a pretty laid back guy. Interested not just in sort of sharing an experience, not just bike riding, but cultural as well, which is pretty important. So, I mean, we haven't talked anything about power numbers, threshold power, amount of climbing and all this sort of stuff. These aren't the sort of experiences we're talking about here. So I think so I wanted to sort of move from that, knowing a little bit about your background, Gus, and just hearing you talk about it, not in a flashy way or anything, but just experiencing parts of the world and, the beauty of it by traveling on bike and the people that you meet and so on. Maybe we can go from that into looking at the sort of experience we're trying to craft with these expeditions. Because it's really hard we've spoken about this before, it's really hard just with a few words on a website to communicate what the feel of the trip is. I mean, if I was sitting here on my computer looking at it, it'd be like, well, I'd have so many questions, right? I'd be thinking, oh, well, is this the sort of experience that I want? These guys are, are these people all, ultra endurance weapons? Are they athletes? Am I too old? Am I too young? Am I going to be left behind? Am I going to be, do I have to ride 15 hours a day and sleep in the ditch? All these sorts of things come to mind. So it's really hard to sort of walk through all of that just in a few words on a website. So I guess how would you describe the experience we're trying to craft with these expeditions, Gus?
Yeah, that's a good one. I mean, yeah, like you said, we've talked about it. It's hard to convey that in just a few words or a few sentences. But I think the experience that we are trying to create and to provide is something that, first of all, begins and ends with fun, with having a good time, enjoying yourself. It's a big commitment to make that trip, whether it's to South Africa or Romania or to Argentina. For wherever you're coming from in the world, generally, you're making a bit of a commitment, not only in the cost, but the time, taking that leave or that break from work and family. So I really believe, and I think, we share that belief, that if you're going to come all this way to come and ride an expedition, you don't want it to just be a suffer fest, where you just, like you say, you're sleeping in the ditch every night, you're riding 18 hours a day, and that's not at all the sort of vibe that we're trying to create. We really want people to come here and have the experiences that we've sort of had, where, you do an amazing ride each day, and that might be, anywhere between 6 to 8 hours is I think sort of generally the good amount of time on the bike. Because I think if you get much more than that, if you get to 12 hours on the bike or even 10 hours on the bike, you start to miss out on all of the amazing things that you're riding past, whether that be the scenery, whether that be the wildlife, the people, the buildings, the geography, you know, the architecture, whatever it might be. These places have got so much going on. So it would be a shame to just, you know, fly past it on the bike and not see it. So I think, yeah, it's got to have a good mix. You've got to have some really nice riding in there that's challenging but also really rewarding, and it's achievable. You've got to obviously, you know, you've got to keep fueled on the bike. You've got to eat. So, you know, the cuisine is pretty important, and we really try to incorporate the local cuisine as much as possible. And, you know, here in a place like Argentina, it's such a part of their cultural fabric, the food and the wine that they eat, but also how they eat it. You know, so that's something that's really important. You know, we really try to expose people to the local cuisine. You know, here in Argentina, that's a lot of empanadas and a lot of steak, and also a lot of beautifully fresh fruit and vegetables. You know, something very, very different to what they get back home. And then, you know, the accommodation where we stay is very, very diverse, particularly, you know, between South Africa, here in Argentina as well. We're staying in all sorts of different places. You know, we try to have people stay in, you know, local, typical style hotels, stay with actual local families on farm stays, you know, and eat meals in their dining rooms or in their kitchens. You know, also stay, you know, places like wineries or game farms, you know, so really, really different places. And we don't like to stay in the same style of hotel every night, because that would get pretty boring and a bit monotonous. But yeah, we try to really mix it up and get creative with the accommodation where we stay. But, you know, I think the important thing for people as well is that, you know, like you say, you don't want to be sleeping in the ditch. You know, having a shower at the end of the day, being able to sleep in a comfortable bed and having a nice meal, I think all a part of that expedition experience for us. So, yeah, it's a really all-encompassing, all mixed thing of having fun on the bike, meeting and interacting with local people, seeing the wildlife, seeing the incredible changes in scenery and landscape, and then, you know, staying in these incredible places that it would just be very hard to find. Like you said, if you just kind of took a flight and rocked up. So yeah, that I think hopefully that sums up a bit the experience, or gives people a bit of an idea of what it's like.
No, it's a good one. You did well, Gus. Having come from all day speaking Spanish to suddenly jump back into English again, I'm surprised you haven't just slipped back into Spanish at times. But you're doing great. But I like to look at it in terms of, like, it's the trips that we're crafting here, the expeditions. From the riding side, it's challenging, but we'll help get you through. I think you heard from Gus earlier that, and amongst our team as well, we've got the experience to craft an experience where we're not just drawing a line on the map as well. People come from too far to and invest too much time and effort into this to just have a line on the map that we're just going out and riding. We've just booked some random places along the way to stay. It's not that at all. So, I mean, Gus and I, we spoke at length over months trying to craft this Salta trip. I mean, it's largely Gus's efforts that have brought it to fruition, but, you know, just crafting the routes, like working out where we're going to do recce rides, how are we going to come up with an acclimatization strategy to get people safely up to 4,000 plus meters. So we're not just drawing lines on the map. It's sort of based on our experience, carefully constructed, but that will result in a challenging ride, but, you know, we're going to help you get through it. I mean, some of the stuff that you see, the scenery and so on, it's just otherworldly. And so, yeah, carefully constructing that route is critical. And I guess that the experience isn't, like, as Gus is saying, it's not a it's not about getting to the top of the climb first and all that sort of thing and having supreme fitness. Sure, you need to have some base fitness to be able to get through that sort of thing. But we want to see people, you know, take on these challenges, take on these bold challenges and help them get through it. Because, I mean, there's nothing more satisfying for someone than setting a goal like that, setting a challenge and being able to work their way through it with a bit of support. So, and I think we've seen such a diverse mix already of people come through on these expeditions just in the first two, haven't we, Gus? It's been such a wide mix.
Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely. We've had people from, you know, all over the world, really. South Africa, Melbourne, Sydney, you know, just recently we've had it, Canada, the US, like, yeah, people from all over. So it's quite amazing, you know, and hearing them all, hearing all of their different stories and meeting them all on the first day, you know, you realise that, wow, it's such an interesting mix of people that have come to ride. And, you know, one of the big things for me that's so rewarding, but also, you know, it stays with you for a long time, is that you become friends with this group of people after eight days or so of riding together and sharing the road. You know, you sort of become, you have these newfound friends from other places, other parts of the world, which is pretty cool.
No, that's good. I mean, there's been a wide range of ages as well. We've had people, I don't know, we've had people across the age spectrum as well, like people who might have been a bit nervous coming in, going, oh, you know, not sure if I'm going to be able to do this, but I'm willing to have a good crack at it, through to people who are a bit younger and maybe a little bit more confident, and maybe they ended up struggling a bit more, to be honest. So it's been a big, diverse group, hasn't it? So we've had people well into their 60s, right? Had people,
yep.
People under 30 as well, perhaps.
Yeah, maybe I think we may have had a few sneak in just under the 30. Yeah, but like, as you say, super diverse. I mean, yeah, in this last trip here in Argentina, there was some debate going on as to who's actually the eldest here, you know, amongst the group, because, you know, people were saying, oh, I think I might be the oldest, and then someone else was saying, oh, I don't know, maybe. But, yeah, I mean, it just goes to show this type of riding, this style of riding, you don't need to be a, you know, a world tour professional with a super high threshold and, you know, watts per kilo. You don't need to be thinking about that at all. And, you know, we've seen it time and time again in not just the expeditions, but I know in the flashbacking rides and a lot of the events and rides that we've done, is that, especially over the multi-day kind of riding, is that the people who are more experienced and have done more of that style of riding, and that usually comes with age and experience, generally perform better later in the expedition.
And the touring legs.
You know, yeah, just that touring legs and that diesel engine, that you know, years of endurance and experience can really help when it comes to this style of riding, because it's the idea is to never go really close to your threshold. You want to just be cruising along and enjoying it every day. And so, yeah, we've really found that some of the elder people, you know, people with more experience actually become stronger towards the end of the trip. So, yeah, the age range is super diverse. Yeah, I wouldn't really consider it a limiting factor by any means. It would be more just having the preparation, making sure that you've done a bit of training and making sure that you're sort of, you know, your bike and your equipment's ready. That's more of the important stuff. Mm. So, yeah, age is definitely not a limiting factor by any means.
Absolutely. It's interesting too, isn't it? It's a leveler. Cycling's a leveler, and especially, you know, longer distance cycling too. Yeah, you see it time again with these rides. You have these people you know, who might tear off at pace early on, but towards the end of the day, everyone comes back to the same sort of pace and speed. And so it's a real good leveler, that's for sure. But yeah, so we've had a couple of trips now with the Rhino Run Expedition, in South Africa, and we've had the El Gaucho trip that's just finished. I guess, what are some of the, any sort of bike travel you do like this, where it's like a 3D immersive experience, there's got to be part of the joy of that type of travel is you just really never know what's going to happen. Some of the highlights can just be totally unexpected and you just can't plan for it. So are there any special memories that pop out from the trip? So maybe we can think about South Africa to start with. Because I remember a few stories from that one. Is there any fond memories from that one, Gus? Stand out?
Yeah, there's a few. I think for me, riding through that part of Africa, it's like going through a storybook or going, it's as if you're in an old movie, that you grew up with, The Lion King or something like this. The landscapes are just so African and so wild and rugged, and I think I really noticed it on the first and the second day, especially when we rolled into Oudtshoorn, is the animals, the wildlife that you're interacting with. It's just unbelievable. I think the one of the highlights I know for a lot of the touring rhinos from that trip in Africa was the end of the second day, where we rolled into Chandelier or Chandelier. I have to ask Ryan how to pronounce it.
I can't remember.
he always gets me in trouble for my pronunciation. But we rolled into this lodge, and sort of on the veranda of the main restaurant or the main hotel, we sat there and had a beer and had a cold drink, and then Gila, this massive giraffe, just kind of cruised over to the balcony or to the veranda and kind of stuck her head over and was, trying to have a drink of somebody's beer, and it was you could almost reach out and pat her. And I think for everybody it was just this wild thing of having just done this incredible ride over the Montague Pass, a really big Rocky Mountain Pass, and then we rolled down into this place, and you've been greeted by a giraffe. I mean, it was just surreal.
Was that in the treehouse in Oudtshoorn?
That
the treehouse?
No, that was the night after the treehouse. That was the first night. Like, just goes every day was just a completely different, adventure. First night was, staying in the treetop cabins, these literal tree houses built into the treetops, and you can hear monkeys kind of going around sometimes in the night. And then it was Sheila the giraffe the next day. The wildlife just became this incredible talking point. And as everybody was riding along, it became this thing of spotting for animals. Who's gonna spot the next giraffe or zebra?
You would have spotted a few through the Klein crew as well, from memory. I think you had. What did you have through the? What did you see? What animals did you see? You would have seen some zebras.
God, what didn't we see? We had a zebra sort of stalking us for a while, staring at us. And we could all just, we had a staring competition with the zebra and us through the fence, and that was pretty amazing. There was a herd of wildebeest down in the sort of bottom of a creek that we saw, springboks, heaps of springboks just pounding around, or maybe it's pronking around, I think is the verb that you're meant to use for them. Check with Riley on that. And then that same day, on the other side of the road, there was, I think it was a mob or a herd of about six giraffe all sort of running along together. And if you've never seen a giraffe in full tilt, sprint, it's quite a sight, because their heads and their neck kind of operate as this weird cantilever sort of system. And it's incredibly funny to watch run, but... that was day two. That was unbelievable. And then when we arrived to the accommodation that night, there was kudu, springbok, and zebra drinking from the watering hole, like literally 10 meters from the again the veranda of that night's accommodation. It was ridiculous. So yeah, just an animal frenzy, you know, that's what Africa is.
And the on that particular course as well, there was, from a riding point of view, you get to sample a whole bunch of those iconic South African gravel climbs, off-road climbs, some that people might be familiar with from the Cape Epic and so on. So there's some fantastic climbs there. I think, what was your favorite one? Because I think, I don't know, the Rooiberg was a pretty special one, but I don't know. What,
yeah.
Were there any that stood out to you or the riders?
Look, I think all of them definitely stood out. They're all pretty solid climbs. I think there was a particular moment on the Rooiberg Pass where, I don't think he'll mind me mentioning his name, but the great DJ Iwan, the great legend from Melbourne, he particularly on that day, yeah, it was a hot day, a very hot day. And at the bottom of the climb, we'd had a, you know, sort of impromptu stop just to get everybody out of the sun, and we stopped in somebody's house and sort of kindly knocked on the door and asked if we could just borrow a patch of their shade for a few minutes, cooled everybody down and had some drinks. And, you know, it was a hot day, and yeah, Iwan, you could see, you know, he was, and he admitted, he said to me, "Mate, I'm struggling a bit here, but I'm going to get through. I've got to do this climb. You know, I've got to, you know, Ryan has to know that I got up this climb." And I said, "Mate, all right, off you go. Let's, you know, no problem." And I mean, it's a technical climb. It comes late in the day, and it's a bit of a beast. But yeah, to his credit, I mean, his head was down for a while, but and there were some very interesting noises coming from the man. It sort of almost sounded like a, you know, a kudu or a zebra, you know, barking. But he just soldiered his way onto the top of the climb, and I was sort of with him or near him, and kind of just helping him along that last bit. And then it was pretty awesome, because when he got to the top, everyone was there, and Uncle Chris UC, who we'll have to talk about as well, you know, he had the car there with a cold can of Coke for him, and I think he was like, he almost broke down at the top. He was so happy and proud of himself, and everybody was there. "Yeah, come on, DJ," and like cheering him in. So that was a pretty special moment, because, you know, he said he was going to do it, and he did it, and he just, you know, ploughed his way up this beast of a climb. Yeah, so that was pretty awesome to see, the great DJ Iwan.
Ian's a good friend of ours. We had a couple of friends of ours on that trip. He's a good mate of ours, Ian. And just knowing the extreme lack of preparation that Ian had before the trip was incredible. So he was, I think he just made his way through that trip out of spite. He didn't want to hear anything from Ryan or anyone else about not being able to make it through. And I think, looking at what Ian did with his extreme lack of preparation, because he was on a big trip beforehand, I think Ian getting through as a touring rhino is kind of up there with Usain Bolt, you know, with his world records in the 100, or Eliud Kipchoge getting under 2 hours for a marathon. I mean, it's kind of up there.
Yeah, no, I'd have to agree with you, mate. It was all time.
Now, Ian's a great fella, and it was really good to see him get through that one. But you mentioned Uncle Chris.
Where do you begin? I mean, you can't go to South Africa and not meet UC, Uncle Chris. I mean, he is a bona fide South African legend and a gentleman, and a scholar, I should say. You could talk all day about him. He's a absolutely lovely, lovely man. A top bloke. He's definitely suffering badly from that top bloke syndrome that we've discussed. You know, he's got a bad case of that. He's full of humour, always just ready with a just classic piece of wit to sort of put you back in your place if you're ever, you know, a sort of a smart aleck to him. But you see, I should mention, he was the king of the expedition. I mean, he was looking after all of us. He was driving the support vehicle, and he was always there with a, you know, cold can of soft drink or a water or some copious amounts of biltong or food. He was the man that kept everybody, you know, sort of on the straight and narrow, and was just such a legend to have along for all of his stories and his wisdom. And, you know, that's another thing that, you know, going back to that experience is, you know, having somebody there who's from that country or from that place, they can speak to all of the history and the stories with so much more knowledge and experience than myself or anybody else ever could. So yeah, Uncle Chris is a massive part of the expedition. And yeah, I know all of the touring rhinos just sort of looked up to him and saw him as a father figure by the end of the tour, and were pretty sad to sort of have to say goodbye, really. But yeah, you see, definitely one of the great legends.
No, it's good. I think one of the things you've done really well, Gus, is find that excellent local support as well. There's no substitute for it. I mean, you've got the experience of traveling around by bike, and we can really shape that experience, but having the support from really experienced locals to just really puts the icing on the cake. I think you've done a fantastic job of making that happen. I think we're lucky as well. Uncle Chris, is he technically Ryan's uncle? Or I think it might be like a second uncle or something like that. I don't really know genealogy.
It might actually be cousin, believe it or not.
Could be cousin, yeah, so that's right.
Yeah, it's confusing, but yeah.
But he's Uncle Chris.
He's Uncle Chris, yeah. I mean, of course.
All right, so we've spoken a bit about the South African experience. I guess, well, one last thing too. We had the unique thing with that trip was we had the touring rhinos witness the front runners from the Rhino Run race come through. How did that unfold?
Yeah, that was definitely a pretty cool highlight that I think, you know, we talked about in the months before. We were sort of talking about, you know, what day should we have the expedition and the race start, and you know, hopefully they can cross over. Oh, that'll be really cool. And in the end, it just worked. It almost worked perfectly. We had ridden our second last day and arrived in Franschhoek. And Franschhoek's a beautiful town in this wine region, a valley that's just full of vineyards. And we'd done really well. We got in early and we got everybody down to the brewery in town just to have a beer and, you know, sort of, you know, we were coming back to civilization, so it was a very different atmosphere. We were sitting down there watching the tracker, and we could see that Benke was leading at the time, and he was pretty close. So we thought, oh, we're just going to wait here. And eventually, yeah, we were sitting there having a beer. We sort of made our way out onto the street as we saw him, his dot descending the pass. And yeah, a few minutes later, you know, we sort of almost blocked the street and blocked the traffic, and Benke's cruising down the road towards us, and he sees, you know, the touring rhinos there in front of him on the road. And I mean, I think all of us were just in shock and ecstatic, and you know, he was sort of, you know, raising his arms going, oh, this is amazing. You know, he'd been on his own and, you know, had a couple of pretty big days, I think, and he hadn't really spoken to anybody. And yeah, we all sort of hugged him and we spoke for a few minutes, and you know, then we sort of, you know, gave him a pat on the back and sent him on his way. But it was pretty emotional to sort of see Benke, you know, having, you know, knowing him and being mates with him, and Jordan, who was also from Giro Cycles in London, was also with us on the tour, and you know, he's also mates with Benke, so it was sort of like a reunion in the middle of this race, in the middle of this tour. But yeah, it was just a bizarre thing to see, like to witness somebody in the midst of a race like that, you know. And it was also another level of, you know, weirdness or really something really interesting, because we had just ridden that whole entree section and we'd done it in 7 days or 6 days. Benki had kind of just done it in a few days. And, you know, for all of us in the Touring Rhinos group, it was just astounding to see him and see him look, you know, quite fresh and as if he'd just gone out for, a couple of hundred Ks. He looked really good, and we were all sort of thinking, oh, geez, and then we've done it in 6 or 7 and we feel pretty tired. And, you know, just that whole understanding of the ride that he had just done to get to that point was something pretty special, and obviously not everybody gets to understand that. And then, over the next 24 hours or so, you know, it was our last day on our tour, and we started seeing, you know, a lot of the other racers come through. We saw Abdullah come through in the dark. We kind of just saw his lights flash by. He was fully racing. So, you know, we saw the brothers from Team Armani. You know, they were coming down in the early morning, I think, as well. And, you know, they were sort of a bit tired, and they definitely weren't expecting a cheer squad or a group of people on the side of the road cheering and calling their names. And I think they were just in shock. So that was pretty awesome. We saw April. April came through just as we were leaving, and then Stephen Lane as well. It was just this crazy thing of seeing all of these guys who you sort of were watching dots for the past week, and you know, everyone really looks up to these guys as people who are doing this amazing thing, and we were sort of just in the middle of it. So that was a real highlight, I think, as well. Being able to be within a race like that, but having a really fun time, pretty cool experience.
Mm. No, it's pretty special. All right, so talk through a bit of the Rhino Run experience, the Touring Rhino experience. What about the one that's probably a bit more fresh in your mind, the El Gaucho trip? Obviously, it's finished about a week ago now, or just under a week. Yeah,
about a week.
Yeah. So, tell us about some of the highlights on that trip. What are the memories that stand out?
For me, it was a really special thing. I'd just done the recon about a month before and, you know, had checked all the roads and all the accommodation and everything like that. And, all was looking really good. We hadn't really anticipated at the time of planning, but we had coincided with Carnival, which Carnival is, unless you grew up in a Latin country, it's probably impossible to understand what it really is, but it's a 4 or 5 day festival, and it just takes over the whole village, the whole town. People come from far and wide to participate in this basically one big party. But the north of Argentina, Jujuy, the province, has become, in the last sort of few years, has become quite famous or quite well known for the best carnival in Argentina. And people come from everywhere, from Buenos Aires, from even overseas, from all over Argentina. So there's this influx of people. And on our day arriving into Jujuy to start the tour was sort of day one of carnival. And I don't know if I can even describe it. I mean, the rituals and the ceremonies that are going on. They have these things that are, the name of them I can't remember, but it's basically a handful sort of size little pile. It's like a snowball, but it's corn flour, and they throw it at each other, and people are just end up covered in corn flour all over their face, their clothes. There's that, and then they have these sort of spray cans of like foam. It's almost like shaving foam, and they're just spraying it everywhere, spraying it over people. They run up to people and spray it in their face, all over their shirt, all over their clothes. And of course, us being the gringos, the tourists or the foreigners, we stick out like sore thumbs. So there was a few moments where I was walking along, and you know, you'd get a girl or a guy just walk past you and just spray you, just fully cover you in spray. And we arrived into Tilcara, this small town, and we had lunch there. The guys got to experience this and just kind of see it. Some of them got a bit more involved. Some of them just sat from a distance and observed. But yeah, it was some pretty funny photos of, I think, myself. I got pretty sprayed a few times, and I know Mary. I heard Mary scream. I think on the day we were leaving Tilcara, she got sprayed by a young girl walking past or something. But it's a very, very rich cultural thing that goes back a long time. And, I mean, you just see hundreds of people all, you know, drinking, playing music, dancing together, young and old, men and women. It's this very, very funny to a foreigner. It's a very sort of funny and strange thing, but you can see the way that the local people embrace it and get excited about it. It's one of the highlights of their year. So that was quite a funny thing. And that night we stayed about 1,000 meters higher in elevation up the valley, way, way up into the mountains. And I went out late at night and I could hear the music going from this town, which was, you know, miles away down the bottom of the valley. And you could hear the music still going at, you know, 3 a.m. or something in the morning. It just doesn't stop for 4 or 5 days.
I remember we're doing the planning for this and we realized, okay, what was going to be going on at that time. And we're like, oh no, how on earth are we going to possibly get through? But we're also thinking, you know what, this could be a bit of a highlight as well, supposing we can actually get through. It turned out, it sounds like it turned out to be a pretty special experience.
Yeah, it was just a really unique experience. And we just made sure that we were early enough on our timing, and we didn't have any sort of traffic issues or anything. So it was quite good. So that was the sort of welcome to the north of Argentina, day one. And everybody in the group, the gauchos, the touring gauchos as we came to be known, they were sort of going, wow, this is pretty exciting. This is pretty wild. So that was day one. That was the welcome.
That's pretty cool. It would have been a real eye opener for them, that's for sure. But then, all right. And so, how did it pan after that? Pan out after that. What were the highlights along the way? I mean, there's so much variety in that course. Big mountain climbs, the salt flats. I think there was like a Burning Man glamping experience thrown in as well. Any other things stand out, Gus? Talk us through it.
Yeah, the Thunderdome. Yeah, look, I mean, the beautiful thing about this route, I really believe it's one of the most impressive routes that you could ride in the world in terms of bang for buck, what you get, you know, what you get to see. It is just mind-blowing how diverse each day is. Even within each day, it's really, really, the contrast is just insane. Our first day, we went from that valley that I mentioned in Tilcara, that small town. We cruised into another small town, Pumamarca, which is known as the valley or the town of, in Spanish, it's the Siete Colores, which is seven colors. And if you've seen some of the photos, the colors of the mountains that this little tiny town sits in, it's just crazy. It's like a watercolored painting. You have bright, rich oranges, dark reds, you know, sort of pastel whites, and then you have these emerald greens all thrown in, and it all just, it's, you're in this little kind of coliseum almost of different of rock color. And that was our second night and on tour. And I mean, the town was also really active with the carnival and lots of music going on. But the colors of the rocks were just electric. They're so, so bright, especially at the sunset at the end of the day. But then it just, evolved as we go through the course. The next day, you know, we had a 40-kilometer climb. Climbing up to, you know, 4,100 meters above sea level, a beautiful, beautiful long climb going up and up and up this valley for hours. And then we ended up finishing on the Salinas Grandes, which is the salt flat. And it was that was the Thunderdome. And we went to the glamping and met experience. It was pretty spectacular. And, you know, we spent the night out on the salt flats in these sort of glamping style pods, and yeah, quite a special, unique experience. Definitely not one that, you know, people can ever have, because it's pretty hard to get out onto the salt flats. But that experience of riding across the salt flats, you know, it's this millions of years of just of change and erosion, and you know, it all used to be an ocean in that part of the mountains. You know, it used to actually be an ocean, and then over the years, all the minerals and things have just slowly filtered down, and you know, the salt has risen to the top, and it's this incredible place. It feels like you're on another planet. But riding across the salt and hearing the crunch of the salt under your tires, you know, they on our way in, we actually go past some salt pools where they make where they produce the salt, and you know, you can sort of put your hand in these pools, and you know, the salt that your hand comes out completely white, covered in salt. It's just, yeah, it's mind-boggling. So, you know, that's just the first 2-3 days. And then, you know, the next day we ride across the Puna, sort of across the salt flats, and then across the Puna, which is a high-altitude plateau. It's, you know, you're at 3,500 meters for most of that day. You know, from then we cross the Puna the following day, and then we descend for 100 kilometers of downhill, which is just like ridiculous to comprehend. And you end up in the jungle. You end up in, it's called, as it's known here, it's a junga, which means the jungle. And you know, we spend the night in a fifth generation tobacco farm in the valley of Tijuana. So the contrast from, you know, where you start the day to where you finish on that day is just insane. The weather's completely different. The temperature's completely different. But down in the tobacco farming valley, it's quite humid, and it's very, very, very green.
So, Gus, so you guys got up to about, you guys got up above 4,000 meters on this trip, right? What was the highest point? It was like 4,200, was it? Or did you, was it a bit higher to get over?
Yeah. Just about 4,200. Yeah, I think okay. It's 4,178 or yeah, something like that.
How did the crew cope with the altitude?
Yeah, really, really, yeah, quite well. I mean, you mentioned the acclimatization plan that we had before, and that's something that you and I spent a lot of time discussing and planning and going through different routes and different ways that we could run the trip, because you know, that is a legitimate thing that you have to really be very much planned for, and you know, you have to take that into account in the planning and the, you know, the sort of contingency planning and the logistical support as well. So the acclimatization plan worked really well in that we, as I mentioned, we spent the first two nights in the one hotel at about, you know, 3,000 odd meters, and that just allowed everybody to really slowly get accustomed and let their bodies adapt to the altitude. And those first 2 days were really just about spending time up at that altitude. And you notice it straight away when you go up there. Your body instantly becomes out of breath. We do a very short and easy shakedown ride up but around that farm where we stay. And it's not even a ride to sort of actually test your legs or anything like that. It's just about getting the body moving, getting some blood moving around the body, you know, blood that's at that point is quite poorly oxygenated. But after a couple of days, your body starts to acclimatize and adapt and adjust. And you know, by the time we sort of got up onto the salt flats and we crested that pass, everybody was sort of starting to feel a bit of strength again. Yeah, I mean, we spoke a lot. We kept, you know, big part of sort of what I was doing, and Pitchy, our support legend, who I have to talk about as well. you know, we were just keeping a close eye on everybody and talking, how was everyone feeling, you know, any symptoms of anything like that. But everybody, yeah, was handling it really well. But a big part of that, I think, was just, you know, having that conversation with everybody, saying, look, when we're at altitude, you know, we don't want to be going above 70% of your maximum effort. It's all about, you know, keeping a lid on your efforts and not getting excited and just trying to, you know, keep your body, you know, relatively relaxed and not push it too hard. Mm. So, no, to their credit, all of the touring gauchos, they really sort of paid attention to that and they listened to their bodies really well, and everybody actually did a fantastic job, because it's no mean feat to go, you know, up to that altitude. As you know, it's hard. It's really quite tough on your body. And our plan, I think, worked really well, and everybody was just very conscious of it, which I think was a big thing, you know, not pushing themselves too hard and just, yeah, taking in the scenery and enjoying it. So, no, I think that worked really well.
So I think that's great to hear. There's a lot of thought and planning that went into all of that. So it's good to hear that the touring gauchos had a great experience up at that altitude. It's a pretty, I mean, they'll come back to sea level with phenomenal fitness as well, that thick soupy blood. they'll be having fun riding with their mates for a couple of weeks, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So there's a 100-kilometer descent mixed in there as well. It wasn't a roaring headwind, so you had to pedal the whole way.
There was a bit of a headwind towards the bottom, unfortunately. Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, we tried our best to you know, speak to the wind gods on that day, but that valley is a bit notorious for the wind. So
we haven't had a chance to catch up on all of that, because I remembered there's that long descent off the Friendship Highway that descends off the plateau, the Tibetan plateau, down into Nepal, into Kathmandu, and they talk about this huge descent. Like, I can't remember how long it is. It's like well over 100 Ks. And I've spoken to four or five people who've ridden it, and they've said it was like a mind-blowing headwind. So while they were descending for, I don't know how long, 150 Ks, it was just, they had to pedal every inch of the way. So I heard that story of your 100 K descent. I was thinking, oh gosh, I hope they didn't have a similar experience.
No, we were pretty lucky in the group. It was not too bad. When I rode it, when I was doing the recon on my own, and I rode it, that I was a lot later in the day, and the headwind was pretty tough. it was a bit of a nightmare. Yeah. But I made sure that we left early in the morning so that we'd sort of get through most of it before the headwind picked up. But I think that's what all around the world, those long descents are. Maybe they all have a headwind just to level it out, stop you from going too fast.
So after that, I remember one of the special memories of my trip when I was in Argentina in that part of the world was we did that big climb up the Cuesta del Obispo, I think it was called. And we got some shelter at a little chapel at the top. But I just remember the views that you get staring out over the mountains, these massive valleys. I mean, it just about brings you to tears. I mean, that sort of scenery, I don't know what it is about it, but it's something that gets at most people. It's just, and until you've had that experience, it's hard to explain, but like staring out over those massive valleys, maybe it's the altitude as well. Well, it's got something to do with it, but there is something special about, you know, getting up these big climbs and being up into the mountains, being a little bit daunted by it all. I mean, it's a phenomenal place. But yeah, so I hope the guys had a great experience up in the mountains. I guess beyond the big passes, you had some Star Wars type landscapes onto the Route of 40, isn't it?
Yeah, so that's the descent down into Kachi. And then once you hit Kachi, you're on the Ruta 40, which is the Route of 40, which is very, very world famous highway. It runs most of the length of Argentina. So it's very common to see a lot of motorbike travelers or bike tourers, bike packers out there, you know, doing an adventure up that highway. It's thousands of kilometers long, but the section that we ride through on our sort of second and third last days, to me, and you've ridden that section as well, yourself and Sarah. I mean, it is like you're on a Star Wars movie set. The rocks are just incredible. The angle that they come out of the ground and the sort of the size of them, the enormity of them is just mind blowing. And it's this really interesting road because that 20 or so kilometers of section, there's a lot of twists and turns and sort of you're coming through one little section and then the road twists or drops down and then you open up into another section. And yeah, the way that the wind has eroded that particular rock over the years is just it's incredible. There are no words I can think of to describe
it's
it.
It's ridiculous.
You've got to see.
Yeah.
It is ridiculous.
You turn the next corner and it's like, oh, I didn't think my jaw could drop any lower. it just doesn't look real, does it? You sort of, you're heading through that landscape. Yeah, like you say, twisting corners, going over small rises, dropping down into these little flats. And it's just ridiculous. It's hard. It's just impossible to explain. Photographs of it just don't look real. It's almost like it's a movie set and you just like Photoshop some bike riders into it. It just doesn't look, doesn't look right. Yeah.
We'll have to put some of the photos up. I mean, people have probably maybe seen a few already, but the photos are just mind-boggling.
There's a little town just before that section as well. Was it just before or just after? I can't remember. My memory's a bit hazy. It kind of looked like it could have been out of a Star Wars movie as well. You know, one of those little outpost towns with the crazy bars. It looks like some of the architecture on the outskirts look like it could be continuing the Star Wars theme.
Yeah, well, so we stayed in that town. We spent one night in that town in a hospedaje, so in a home with Monica and Sergio, who is this lovely local couple. And you know, they put us up in their house and Monica made an incredible meal with all this local beautiful vegetables all growing in the valley and wine growing, you know, just down the road as well. So that town is like it's almost like the Flintstones as well, you know, because everything's rocky, everything's dusty, it's just sand.
Yeah, that's right.
And we should mention the rocks are all like this sandstone, like brown, light sandstony color, and so it's as if you're in that little Star Wars village or the Flintstones village.
Is it Payagasta or Angastico, is it, or I can't remember what it was.
Angastaco.
I'm not going to get the pronunciation right, am I? Yeah, that's right.
It's a cool town. I really like it.
I got some memories, some really distinct memories of riding into that town going, all right, what's going on here?
Where are we?
I was expecting to see those Star Wars cruiser things that skim across the sand, like come Well, like, oh, it's just, it's such a wild place.
It looks like, how can anybody live here? Like, it's so dry and it looks kind of like you say weird almost when you're coming in, but it's a hive of activity and it's quite a small town, very much so, but it's a beautiful place
full of lovely people. Definitely a local hub for commerce and, you know, shopping and that sort of thing.
And it's one of the towns that not many people go into because you actually have to turn off the road and
go
a couple of k's to get in. So it doesn't get as much tourists and as many tourists and as much activity as some of the other towns. Mm. So for that reason, I quite like it. But it's this amazing contrast of these sandstony rocks, and then over in the distance, if you've got a clear day, you can see the Nevado de Cachi, which is a massive snow-capped peak. You know, so you've got this green valley, green and river going on in the middle. You've got these sandstone rocks on one side, the Star Wars kind of movie, and then in the distance, you've got snow-capped peaks. Like, it just, there's just too much going on. It's just too much.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I guess if you, speaking of the Route of 40, so this is the Route of 40 heads through here, right? But then you, if you head north from there, you go through, you end up getting, you go up a bit higher, you get to a little town called La Poma, and then it's basically up and over to the Salt Flats where you guys rode on the tour the other side. And it gets up to, you're over, to ride the Route of 40 over that volcano, the side of it, it gets above 5,000 meters, doesn't it, Gus?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it does.
Are we going to chuck that in the expedition as an A-line, you reckon?
Oof. it would be a very much, it would probably be like a double A-line or an A-plus line. It's, I've had an adventure along that road before, and it's a few years ago, and it's a crazy climb. And the problem, what they actually have in the summer is the road is typically closed for the entire summer because that's when most of the rain comes, and there's a lot of snow melt as well. And it ends up, this river ends up forming, and it just completely destroys the road. I mean, you're talking 10, 20 meter sort of drop offs where the water just cuts and destroys this road. And so they have to wait till the end of the summer, and then they send a bulldozer and a whole heap of machinery up to open the road again. So it's actually only through winter that it's really passable or safely passable. But yeah, it's 5,000 meters the road where it takes you over the pass, and that's pretty high. 5,000 meters on the bike,
and the mountains got up above that.
And the mountain up above it, I think, gets up over 6,000 meters, the summit. So you're on top of the world. You can see so far when you're up there. But might be an A plus line,
maybe in future years down the track. We skip out on that in the expedition. But you did get some phenomenal stuff either side, which is pretty cool. Tell us about, we spoke about UC, Uncle Chris, in South Africa. Who did you find? Which local legend did you have helping with running the show in Argentina?
Well, there's probably two local legends that need to be mentioned, but the first one, we have to mention the Prince of Salta. Now, I met the Prince of Salta in almost my first day, I think, arriving into Salta. I was given this very warm welcome, you know, welcome to Salta. Now, the Prince doesn't speak perfect English, but he speaks pretty good English. And, you know, and he's actually studying English, so he's always trying to improve his English. So he really enjoyed meeting me because, you know, he can practice his English a lot. But the Prince of Salta is he's the heart and soul of the city here. He is he's a lovely, lovely man. He runs a hostel. He owns an apartment which he sort of manages as well. And he does a whole heap of things for the town and the community, but also for tourists coming through and big tour groups, and does everything from organizing big, you know, catering functions and events to sort of obviously running the hostel and running events and parties in the hostel. And he's the type of guy that you want on your team. He knows everybody. He knows everything. If you need something in Salta, he knows exactly who to go to get it.
That's why he's the prince. So he's not, I mean, Salta's not a monarchy, right? So it's technically not a, he's technically not a real prince, right? So he's not going to ascend to the throne one day to become king, perhaps, but he's as good as a prince.
he's as good as a prince. I mean, no, it's in the letter of the law, he's not the prince, but I mean, for me, he's the prince. He's a legend.
Yeah.
And, you know, for me, obviously, I mean, I came out here, you know, 3 months ago almost, you know, to spend the time to get everything organized, to get everything ready, because, you know, it's a place where things do take time. And yeah, meeting the prince was very helpful, because he was able to help with everything from finding other partners to hotels and all sorts of things. So
I don't know how you do it, Gus. You were like a truffle pig with sniffing out and finding these remarkable contacts. No matter where you go in the world, Gus, you have a knack for this, finding these very special people to help you with, you know, with what you're doing, but also just to probably enrich your own travels as well.
Yeah, it's always nice to meet people like the prince, you know, and you meet them all over the world, but these people who are just warm and open, and they're willing to sort of help a traveler out, or help somebody out, you know, who you don't always get that all around the world. So it's pretty special when you do meet those people. But he's definitely very much one of those. But he was integral in helping get everything ready. But our other, you know, key part of the puzzle was Pichi. Pablo Pichi is his name, and Pichi came with his mate Alejandro. So they were actually a two-part deal, and Pichi and Alejandro sort of over the course of the expedition took turns in supporting us and you know, being that support vehicle, which is very important on all of our expeditions. You know, it's important to have a support vehicle there in terms of safety, but, you know, carrying extra parts and water and food and that sort of thing. But I mean, Pichi particularly is a legend of Salta as well. You know, there's a photo of him. One day we were crossing the Puna, and there was nothing for 100 kilometres. So I'd organised with Pichi, all right, Pichi, we're going to need to do a picnic out in the middle of the Puna, because there's nothing out here. So we'd organised for some sandwiches, and I said, oh, you know, do you reckon you could, and before I could even finish the sentence, Pichi said, yeah, no problem, I can make a coffee, we can have water, we can have this. And anyway, we rocked up into literally the middle of the Puna, and there was this little picnic table with a blanket, a llama's wool blanket draped over it, and he had the sandwiches set up there. You know, he had some chips and other sort of cereal bars, some fruit, and it was like, what is going on here? We're in the middle of literally, you know, it's like we're on the moon, and then Pichi's got this amazing picnic set up, and then he had his little gas stove going, brewing coffee on a percolator. It was just all over it.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so he was an all-time legend. But I should add that while he's doing all of this, he's wearing the typical gaucho sort of uniform, which is a boina, which is that sort of beret-looking hat that people may have seen. It's something that the gauchos typically wear. Wearing a poncho draped over him, and drinking from his mate, which is the typical tea that most, almost every Argentine drinks through a metal straw. And he'd just be cruising around every day with his poncho and his boina on, drinking his mate tea, just always with a beautiful story about how things were created, or why this has happened, or what this means on the side of the road. And he's got a beautiful way of telling stories. And as we mentioned with UC Uncle Chris, Pichi is also one of those men, or one of those local people that has an incredible amount of passion for their home country, their culture, and just loves to tell their stories with such passion. And I mean, every time he would start telling a story, it was like story time. All the touring gauchos would stop what they were doing and listen, because, you know, he would tell some incredible story about the Pachamama, the god of the Mother Earth, and how she did this and did that and what it meant. And very, very special to have the Pichi along as well.
No, that's fantastic, Gus. Sounds like you've met some very special people and crafted an amazing experience for people. So we're, geez, mate, I was going to try to keep this to an hour, but we're still trucking on. I just wanted to, if you've got time, Gus, I just wanted to talk briefly about what we've got coming up. There's a, do you have a few more minutes?
Yeah, mate, absolutely.
All right, great. There's, because we've got another trip coming up, the third one. We've invested in trying to build a set of three trips, right? So the third one in the arsenal is Transylvania. Now, I remember
Transylvania
in Romania. So I remember I was hiking around the Carpathians in the year 2000, I think it was, and it was a pretty wild place. And I remember we had to talk about this quite a while ago. And it seemed to be, it was just starting to open up after the fall of communism and so on. That was sort of like 89, 90, after Ceausescu's reign. And so I was at a conference over in Hungary, and I thought we'd just go for a trip over to Romania and have a look around. And it seemed it was opening up to the west a bit more, and there seemed to be a lot of amazing wild skiing, and the mountains were phenomenal. Like, you know, quite a large bear population in the forests and the mountains, and so it was a super wild place with a really really wild history, and quite untouched as well. So kind of fast forward 20 plus years, and gravel riding seems to have boomed around the world, and there's a lot of bikepacking stuff that's going on, and but from what I could tell, what we could tell, that some of these untouched parts or undiscovered parts or really, well, less explored parts of Romania didn't seem to be getting much attention. And it was a pretty special place when I was hiking around the area like 20 plus years ago. So there's a bit of a connection there. And maybe I'm completely wrong. Maybe there's this I've just missed something, and there's like a massive crew of people that go and explore this part of the world. But it seems to be, it's like, it's pretty accessible from, it doesn't seem like it is though. It's pretty accessible from Western Europe as well. But it is super wild. And I guess that was kind of like my start for the discussion with you, Gus, about, all right, what could we do, somewhere in Europe. And I think, you might've had similar thoughts. Like, what was the origin of it for you?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? The origin of it for me was, I think, my travels through Kyrgyzstan and Mongolia, Central Asia, and countries that had gone through a similar experience, you know, with a regime or a very complicated history. And there's a lot of similarities in the culture there between that eastern part of Europe, the Balkans and the Soviet Union, and just the history is mind-boggling. So it had always just been on my map, on my radar, is definitely a place that I had wanted to go, all through the Balkans. And then the more looking into the map and the more sort of looking at what some road options might be, Transylvania sort of came out to be the spot. And then it just sort of developed, and I managed to get over there last year in the late summer for a bit of reconnaissance, and hooked up with a local friend of ours, Levy, who's helping us with the expedition as well. And had this amazing experience. I mean, again, talking about our other two expeditions and all of the other stuff that comes with riding in a place like this: the culture, the food, the history, the architecture, the society and their way of life. It was a very, very, very different Europe to what you get in France or Italy or Spain, where most people go to ride their bike. It's a very, very different part of the world. And wild, I think, is the key word. Like, as you mentioned there, it is a wild place where, farming is a huge part of what they do there. The agriculture is massive. They grow a lot, but it's not uncommon to be riding along and, you look to your left or right and you know, there's a field of workers there, you know, hundreds of people hand picking potatoes from the ground or cutting hay with a scythe, you know, and horse-drawn carriages and carts carting all of this produce all over the place to the nearest town or the market. It's a place that's quite a lot has changed, I think, from when you went there, but at the same time, not a lot has changed. So it's very, very unique and different place to anything out there, I think, in terms of what it has. Very, 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 very interesting.
Mm. Yeah, I know the Transcontinental Race, the TCR's been through Romania a couple of times. So yeah. Has had a bit of a taste of endurance cycling, and our mate Levy as well is pretty well known in the country too. Levy, who you're talking about, pretty well known in the country for his endurance cycling exploits, that's for sure. So
yeah.
I guess you've got some great contacts again over there to craft another great experience, Gus.
Yeah, no, it'll be a really interesting one. And I mean, as you said, it's very accessible. I think I flew from London, you know, to Bucharest. It's a 3-hour or thereabouts flight. So it's something that you can, you know, you can almost get over there for a weekend trip, you know, for most people. But yeah, it's slightly different. It's a slightly shorter format. So, you know, it's something where people can sort of cruise over from UK or mainland Europe and get there. And it's basically a week in total that you'd have to sort of take off from work or be away from home. So it's a slightly different trip. It's definitely something that's very accessible for people living in Europe or the UK, being so close. But it's amazing to have something so wild and so, you know, that feeling of utter remoteness, but it's something that's so close. You know, yeah. It's quite unique in that sense.
All right. So that's kicking off in August as well.
August.
So we've still got some slots available for that one too. I guess it's interesting as well, Gus, with this first, where we knew it was going to kind of pan out this way. You go through the first round of trips, and it's a bit of a hard sell sometimes for people, because I guess maybe because of the stuff that we're talking about right at the start of the conversation, it's like, well, one, do you know if it's real? Do you know if it's for me? What's the sort of experience that I'm going to have? But yeah, we've found as soon as we've run the trips, then, like for instance, South Africa, the South African trip last year, that was put on in October, and I think we've got two tours already pretty much fully booked for the
end of this year. That's right.
And we're considering a third one as well, Gus, I think, aren't we?
We are. I mean, it's pretty amazing that we've got two pretty much, yeah, almost fully sold out, the second one. Mm. So, yeah, I mean, there is the opportunity to run a third. I mean, I think you're very much right. I think people, it's always a bit daunting going to one of these places, and I think it's much more reassuring to know that some other people have been there before you and sort of taken the first step, and you know that it works and everything like that. But yeah, we've got quite a bit of interest as well for Argentina in 2024. So yeah, I think it's only natural that people sort of want to see how things play out maybe a bit first. But yeah, I think we're sort of showing that, you know, the type of experience that we're trying to create is unique and it's special, and it's definitely not as if you're just going to rock up to Bucharest in August or to Stellenbosch in October and, you know, you'll be on your own or anything like that. We're very much, you know, sort of crafting something that where you'll be looked after.
Yeah. No, it's great. All right, Gus. Well, there's a whole bunch of, you know, questions, I guess, that we've been asked and you get asked about these trips. And I think we've covered most of them in our chat today, but I think for most of the questions we've had, we've got an answer for, you know, whether it's can I store my bike box during the expedition somewhere, through to, what gear do I need to bring and how does a typical day pan out. I think, you know, all of these sorts of things we've got covered. The worries that we've been really thinking through sometimes for months before these trips are things like acclimatization and how that works, and making sure we've got the right local support who understands exactly that sort of experience. So, but I think, yeah, we don't have to, I don't think we need to run through too much more of that, but I think hopefully this conversation today has helped kind of explain a little bit more about what we've been doing and give you a feel for the trips that have happened so far. I guess it sounds like, Gus, there's just been some pretty special moments with a mix of different people from all different backgrounds from around the world that sort of end up sharing a bit of fun and some laughs along the way, and yeah, and some new friendships probably as well.
Yeah, no, it's been a pretty amazing experience, and yeah, I mean, from my perspective, I'm very fortunate to have ridden and spent time with all of these people, and just had the pleasure of being there to help these people along on a pretty special adventure. So I think there's lots of funny moments and stories and experiences, and it's the kind of thing where, you know, some of them are told in various stories and things, but a lot of them are just between that crew that comes along to South Africa or to Romania or to Argentina, wherever it might be, and that special group of people, however many people it is, they kind of have that shared experience and that shared bond for forever then. It's been a pretty special thing, but the most important thing is having fun, and you know, coming away to one of these countries and has having a great experience with a bit of everything, some riding, some culture, some history, some food, some, you know, everything, and really interacting with the local way of life, not having an insulated experience. So no, I think it's been a pretty fun experience for everybody so far, and yeah, I think this next year is going to be even bigger, with two tours in South Africa and a new place in Romania to visit. So yeah, I'm looking forward to what the next year brings with more people and more adventures.
Oh, that's fantastic. So what's your plan from here, Gus? You're in downtown Salta at the moment. What's the plan for the next little while?
Well, I'll be back in Melbourne April, early mid-April, I guess. I haven't got much longer left here. It's 9 p.m. local time, so restaurants are kind of just starting to open up, which is, you know, for dinner, and people are kind of just thinking about finishing work, so very different way of life over here.
Yeah, the siesta culture takes some getting used to, doesn't it?
Yeah. I'll be here just tidying things up for a little bit longer, and then making my way back to Melbourne, and I'm looking forward to finally getting back to Australia after quite a few months and seeing the family and spending some time in the Adventure Dojo, mate, back in Melbourne. All of the team. Because of the time zone here, I haven't been able to jump on the regular, you know, team call every Wednesday afternoon. So I've been just sending through one-way videos of myself and what I'm doing, but I'm looking forward to kind of getting back and seeing everybody and catching up. It's been a long time. So yeah, and speaking English again, my brain's melting from learning a new language.
We've enjoyed the video updates along the way. The teams love them. But yeah, you'd be pretty excited getting back to see family too, up near Narrabri, right?
Yeah, up on the farm. There's been lots going on in the family. We've got all the cattle to take care of, and lots happening in the family. So yeah, I'm looking forward to getting back to them. And mother has been mother's always got a healthy level of concern and worry, but so it'll be good to just put her abate her fears, and you know, she won't have to worry for much longer.
Oh, fantastic. Oh, it'll be good. You've been on the road for a long time, Gus, so it's I'm sure it'll be great to come back and see the family. But I think, look, huge thanks to you for all the hard work you've done. I think a large part of these expeditions is the experience, and that's kind of like led by who's it's shaped by who's leading it, right? So it's your personality that's coming through in these experiences too. And I couldn't think of a better person to be running that part of it, mate. So hats off to you, and thanks for all your hard work. And yeah, these are really some bucket list experiences you're creating for people here. So hopefully proud of what you've achieved so far. And yeah, we certainly are. We're very lucky to have you on the squad, helping us out with this sort of thing. So yeah, well done, mate.
Thank you, mate. It's been an awesome journey and an absolute pleasure. And no, thank you.
Well, it's just after 9 PM, as Gus said. People are starting to think about coming home and getting cleaned up in the next few hours. Sometime close to midnight, they might be heading out for dinner. So,
yeah.
We'll let you get into the evening. So thanks for your time, Gus. And
thank you.
We'll look forward to seeing you sometime soon. Hopefully in Melbourne after you've seen your family back up at the farm.
Yeah, no, mate. I'm excited to get back to the Adventure Dojo and see the team, see everybody, catch up, mate, have a beer and yeah, share some stories.
All right, Gus. We'll leave it at that. Thanks for your time. And if you have any more questions out there about these expeditions, there's plenty of ways to get in touch with us. Just reach out via our website, our social channels, and fire away any questions that you've got. And hopefully, we'll see you on a trip sometime soon.
Yeah. Cheers. Awesome.
All right. Thanks, Gus.
No worries. Ciao.
Okay, there you have it. That was Gus live from his hotel room in Salta, Argentina, after another very successful expedition. It was great to talk to Gus. He's been on the road for a very long time, and yeah, we are very lucky to have him on board. Now, if you've got any further questions about expeditions at all, our expeditions, just drop us a line through any of our contact points. So we've even got an email address for them. There's expeditions@curvecycling.com, and you can ask Gus everything you want to about the trips, or get in touch with us through any of our social channels, which you can find on our website, www.curvecycling.com. On our site, you'll also find a spot where we cover the expeditions that we have on the go as well, and you can find out some more details on what to expect each day. All right, that's it for this episode. Thanks for joining us on the Race Ride Seat podcast. Hopefully we'll see you out on the trail soon.